Good morning. Well, as I was saying, it is a story that has dominated the news agenda this week, the pressures that many of our police officers are under. And this, of course, all started with a tweet from the PSNI Chief Constable, George Hamilton, who told an officer, dry your eyes, do the job or move on if they couldn't cope with the job. Now, to be fair to the Chief Constable, they were not talking about mental ill health in that Twitter exchange. The Deputy Chief Constable, Drew Harris, here today. Drew, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Good morning. I don't want to focus this interview at all on the Chief Constable's comments, so let's just get that sorted first of all. What was his mindset when he said it? To make a mistake, you've got to have a particular mindset. What was his mindset when he told officers to dry their eyes?
Well, the Chief Constable's been quite clear. Subsequently, he was, withdrawn those comments and apologised for them, and even today has said that they were inappropriate. And I think George has to be judged by his actions. Tweeting is a dynamic exercise. It can quickly become controversial, as we've all seen. But if we judge the Chief Constable by his actions, you can see throughout his career and as the Chief Constable, he's been there always in a leadership role.
But was he tired? Is that a manifestation of him being tired, him being frustrated with the rank and file? What was that all about?
No, he's not frustrated with the rank and file at all. The Chief Constable and all of us are very proud of the work that the police service does, both our staff and our officers. They do an incredible job. Over the last year, we've seen crime fall, we've seen detections increase. Our performance is good and we've delivered in a time of austerity.
But I'm not too sure that he has pulled back from the tough message within the mistake, which is if you can't do the job, get another one. There are plenty of people who will. Has he pulled back from that?
Well, that is in no way our ethos in the organisation. We are an organisation of over 9,000 staff and officers, and we are here to provide a service to the community in Northern Ireland. Our first purpose is actually to serve the community and to protect them from harm. To do that, we need a healthy workforce, a capable workforce, and a workforce which is at its work and at its workplace. And in order to do that, we have a lot of support for officers and staff.
Which I'll get into.
Yes.
And that's what I want to focus this interview on. But, you know, after the Chief Constable's apology,
yes,
when he's had an opportunity to talk about this further, both through you on this programme, but also in the Belfast Telegraph today, they're leading with a story. He's given the Telegraph an interview. He does tell his officers and prospective people who want to join the police that they've got to be fit and capable of doing the job. So he is sending that message out again.
Well, to be a police officer, indeed to be a staff member, these are demanding roles. But people go through a difficult and strenuous recruitment process. They receive training, and then whilst in the organisation, they do get support. But we are here primarily to serve the people of Northern Ireland, and we have to do a difficult job in doing that. And as I've said, we do need officers and staff who are capable and competent to do that. But it's my role, it's the role of the Chief Constable and other managers to make sure that we do all we can to assist them in that and provide them leadership and support and the resources to do that.
OK, so I do want to move into scrutiny now over how much help are officers getting in Northern
yes.
Ireland. And before I do so, I do want to reflect at the very top of this interview the sentiment that is coming from the public to me, which I'll pass on to you,
yes,
which is one of gratitude. That you're a senior manager, but you're also a police officer. You're also, therefore, putting your life on the line because there are dissidents trying to attack people like you and other police officers. And I think it would be wrong of me not to pass on the gratitude to every single one of you who put on a uniform to care for people like me, my family and the audience to this programme.
So, thank you very much. Thank you.
OK. So that's the nice bit.
Thank you.
Right. Now, what I want to spend the rest of this interview doing is to convey to you the deep concern that some of your officers have sent to this programme that they are not cared about and that they are used and they're essentially exploited because they put on a uniform, they do the job and there is not enough support for them, particularly about their mental health and well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two different categories here. Former officers who have now left the force and present officers. So let's deal with those officers first, Assistant Chief Constable, who have left the force. Here's an example of a police officer. In fact, this police officer is about to leave the force. He's yes. going to resign this month, is my understanding. Let's have a listen to what he told this programme.
PTSD is a catch-all phrase. One that is mentioned. It doesn't mention anxiety. It doesn't mention depression. It doesn't mention disruption of family. It doesn't mention alcoholism. It doesn't mention recovery. It doesn't mention pressures that you carry from work into the home. You don't hang your hat up on the back of the door and then go home without seeing what you've dealt with for the previous 12 hours or what you've seen 3 weeks ago or what you've heard. Policing is a difficult job. It's not something you go into lightly. I knew what I was going into. I had to, with the guidance of my family doctor, seek further assistance outside the police service. I need to be fixed. Of all the things I ever lost, Mr. Nolan, I missed my mind the most. I don't have the clarity of thought. I don't have the ability to function.
He is currently hiding in a cave, he tells us, because he's frightened and he's broken.
Well, yes, and I heard the interview on Monday, and indeed I'm aware of the case, and as I listened, I realised that I had a knowledge of the case and the circumstances surrounding it. And what I would say is that officer has been through a very difficult time, obviously, and he will be leaving the organisation. We, through our occupational health and welfare unit, have assisted that officer. But the purpose of our occupational health and welfare is as a supplement to other services available either through the National Health Service or through private health insurance that an officer might have. The primary focus of the occupational health unit is to identify officers who may be in stress or indeed in other conditions early and see what we can do to shorten the time that they may be off, even prevent them going off sick in the first place, and aid their recovery and aid their return to work. Unfortunately, in this officer's circumstances, that is not possible, and unfortunately has to leave the organisation. And we do have a number of those cases ongoing at any one time. Unfortunately, the officer was injured in the course of his duties. That is quite clear. The circumstances he set out in terms of going to assistance of another officer are accurate, and that's how he was injured. And that is regarded then as an injury on duty. And unfortunately, he has been unable to recover from the injuries he sustained in that incident.
And you can't do much about him being able to physically recover from injuries, but you can do an awful lot about supporting him psychologically.
And he would have got that support, psychological support.
How many sessions?
Well, I don't want to go into the details of the sessions an individual might receive, but it is not for me or any police officer to say to our clinical experts, our clinical practitioners, what support they provide. Because once they go into OHW, in effect, that becomes a patient relationship that they have with our OHW. And of course, if they need treatment, if they need assistance, that will be provided. And they do, and our OHW would refer...
Occupational health would refer
individuals on then into the National Health Service.
You're responsible for welfare, police officers, correct?
Well, yes, I do have that overall responsibility, and it's a responsibility I take seriously and have taken very seriously over a number of years now.
Are the amount of sessions that a police officer will get capped?
No, they're not. The amount of sessions an officer get depend on the clinical needs of that officer and how far our occupational health and welfare staff can actually take an issue. It may be that they have to be referred on to other psychiatric services within the National Health Service, or indeed if the officer, as I've said...
Other psychiatric services outside the police service?
Yes.
Why wouldn't you keep it within the police family? That's what the military do.
Well, We have an occupational health unit, which is there to assist us in keeping people at work and bringing people back to work. But we are not there as a full, in effect, treatment suite for officers. We don't have a medical corps. It is beyond our budget, and officers can avail of the services of the National Health Service, and military may be in a position where they're not able to avail of the National Health Service.
Has the mask just slipped, Assistant Chief Constable? That service is there to keep people at work and bring them back to work. Is that really what this is all about? Well, should your service not be there to look after your officers, whether they can come back to work or not, to say thank you, if you put on that uniform and risk your life for us, we will protect you as much as we can, for as long as we can, whether you can come back to work or not?
Well,
really? The service is only there if they can come back to work. Really, Drew?
In effect, we provide a high degree of support. Now, that is the reality of this. We provide more support to our officers than any other police service in these islands. That is without doubt. The investment we've made in this, the investment we've made in increasing the numbers of clinical staff, particularly for psychiatric counselling and a clinical psychologist, and this year alone, far outstrips the resources that others have put to this.
In your police officers in Northern Ireland are double that than England and Wales.
Yes, they are. Yes, the assaults on officers and the threat to officers in Northern Ireland is far beyond what happens elsewhere.
So there should be more help.
Well, that's true, and we have protected that even in times of austerity. We have maintained those resources and indeed have increased them to respond to this upsurge that really we've seen around stress-type ailments.
But why is it only for officers who are either going to be able to come back to work who are still in the job? What's that all about? So if you assess someone that they cannot come back to work, are you done with them?
No, we will go through a programme to see how they can get back to work. But,
What if they can't?
Well, if you take back the first principles of police service, first principles of police service are to prevent, detect crime, in effect to protect people in Northern Ireland. And we do that, as I've said, through a workforce which is at work and capable and healthy and with a sense of well-being. But we are not there, in effect, as a medical service for those police officers. Our function is as a police service to protect this society.
So
there are other. Well, if I might just set out just a full gambit of how we might assist officers. So there's the organisational assistance, but there's also how we as a collective family help each other. And so beyond the organisation, there's the benevolent fund that officers make contribution to.
Yeah, they pay for it themselves, in other words.
Well, the officers make contribution to it, and it's there as a safety net. And I've chaired the benevolent fund now for 8 years. And each year it has funded 260 officers to go to police treatment centres for 2 weeks intensive treatment.
But they're paying for it themselves. What I'm trying to scrutinise this morning is what we as a society, through what we're paying with our taxes, and what you as an organisation, the PSNI, are doing for your officers. Let's stay on this point before we do move from it. So it's about police officers who have the ability to come back to work. And you're saying that you are not a psychiatric service if that isn't the case, and therefore they will be passed to the NHS.
Well, we're not a full medical service. We will provide treatment, and we can make early intervention, which is very important. We can provide support. We can provide recuperative posts. We can find every way to bring officers back into the workplace. But in the end, that may not be possible. Some individuals, you will doubtless have heard from some this week, have been unable to return to police duties, even in a recuperative post.
And what happens to them?
Well, in the end, that would be, in effect, a medical discharge from the organisation.
So?
A medical retirement, in effect. But if I might just set this on a wider page, the police enjoy good terms and conditions. And our terms and conditions are, in respect of sickness, 6 months full pay, then 6 months half pay, and then beyond that, then your pay is cut.
I'm going to get on to that.
Yes, but in part, that recognises the role that police officers have, in that they are expected to get in harm's way. Like, police officers come into work and it is a place of duty. And your duty is, in extremis, and indeed, more than that, quite often, daily, we will have officers who will get in harm's way. And our responsibility as an organisation, and that's reflected in regulation that has gone through, is to protect them and to provide for them in those circumstances where they've been injured in their course of duty, and try and get them back to work.
I'm going to move on to that pretty quickly. But, so what you're saying to me is, while a police officer is still any good to you, while they still have the ability to come back to work, you'll look after them. As soon as your organisation determines through a medical assessment that they might not be any good to you, there's no aftercare, is there? They're on the scrap heap insofar as they're passed to someone else. There's no loyalty from the PSNI to them. There's no money to them. They're passed away.
Well, if they leave under...
to another service.
Well, if but... Well, it's 2 points there.
Yes.
We don't have all the services. We don't have all the services that officers might need. Neither are we. And that is not our function. Our function is about police in Northern Ireland.
You have an occupational health unit.
Yes.
Why does that... Because I know, because I've spoken to some of the experts. Actually, for someone trying to recover from a mental health issue, one of the very helpful components in that would be to stay with the same practitioner, medical practitioner that has been helping you, because you build up a level of trust with that person, you build up a relationship, it can often last a long time. There are some people in therapy for 2 years, 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, what you do as an organisation, and I'm also talking about you here, I'll repeat that, but you are the Deputy Chief Constable.
Yes.
And you're responsible for overseeing the welfare of the police officers who a dissident will be trying to kill today, who will run into danger for this community. What you do to those police officers is that you stand over a system which essentially tells them, if you are no good to us, we will say it's your future medical care, psychiatric care, is nothing to do with us. And actually, that person needs to stay with the medical practitioner, psychiatric practitioner that they've started their journey with. And you say no.
Well, there are once an individual may leave the service, there are support mechanisms for officers beyond that, and the benevolent fund that I've spoken about.
No, they pay for it themselves. By the PSNI. Let me cut to the chase. Why are they not staying within the occupational health unit?
Well, we do not have the resources to maintain that relationship.
Yes, you do. You could prioritise the resources.
Well, we spend 2.4 million a year on our OHW.
Spent more on your officers who are risking their lives for us. Why would you not do that?
I've set out our officers. Well, it will take in the round. Our officers at the moment are really well equipped, the best equipment they've ever had.
That's not what this is about.
Overall, how are we looking after officers?
No, how are you looking after your officers psychologically, Chief Constable?
Well,
in trouble, when they're suicidal.
Well, the part of the object of this is that we avoid that in the first place, and part of that is actually the well-being of officers throughout their career, and being responsive to their needs. So being responsive to shifts, overtime, requests for equipment, and their conditions of service, and actually dealing with some of the pressures that they are identifying around bureaucracy and around demand, and focusing them on what we want.
How on earth does equipment affect your post-traumatic stress disorder? How does equipment affect your suicidal thoughts, your trauma?
Well, what we want to avoid is people getting to that in the first place.
You can't avoid it if they're going and picking up a dead body and putting it in their body bag. You can't.
Well, but you can mitigate it through early intervention, peer support, recognising traumatic incidents that might have an effect on officers. Last year, 220 officers went through a process where we identified perhaps an incident where there was a lot of stress following a trauma incident, and we provided stress debriefs.
Are you sure?
So there's a lot about intervention early up, early on that we have taken on, Stephen.
Are you sure that you and your chief constable should not be reviewing a system which is essentially saying to every officer within the police family at the moment, if you get into psychological trauma because of what you do on duty, there will be a definite time frame during which you better get better, or else that psychological support from the police will stop? Because, well, again, I assure you that any medical psychiatric practitioner in this country or further afield will say you cannot rush that care. You can't put a time frame on it.
Well, and so, well, what I've set out to you is then early intervention, dealing with these incidents as they happen, getting supervisors to recognise them, but also appealing to officers, put your hand up if you feel that there's some that you're running into difficulty. Approach a supervisor, approach your federation representative, approach OHW directly. You can be assured that the treatment you will receive is entirely confidential. Seek that early treatment. But then if you do have to avail of sick absence, then OHW will look after you. I am not saying that there are a limit on the appointments, but there is actually a limit as to what we can do within OHW. We do employ a psychiatrist.
Pass them on to someone else.
No, we do employ a psychiatrist. There's no waiting. A psychiatrist can be seen within 2 to 4 weeks. We've increased the number of counsellors that we have, and we've brought down the waiting list for that. The Federation money will help around training officers and training supervisors around identifying stress. There's an awful lot going on.
You say early intervention is important.
Yes.
And yet, in the Belfast Telegraph today, you admit that in terms of psychological help for officers, some of your officers are waiting 18 weeks to see a counsellor. Is that true?
The waiting list for counsellors have been reduced, but the longest waiting list at this moment, the longest wait would be in the order of 16 to 18 weeks.
So what have they been reduced from?
Well, we've cut those by more than 50%. So they're well down from about a year ago, because we recognised the problem, and as I said earlier, we've employed 5 additional staff.
So up until a year ago,
but you were
keeping officers waiting 8 months to see a counsellor.
It depended on, but the second part of that was the symptoms that they showed. And so those who had more severe symptoms were seen quicker. There was a triage around how quickly people were seen. And so those with milder symptoms had to wait longer.
Why are you still keeping people waiting 13 weeks?
Well, I'd say by the end of this year that those waiting times will have reduced to a few weeks. And indeed, even beyond that, there is no waiting time for the police treatment centres, and they also provide care for individuals suffering from stress. Also then, we introduced telephone counselling, which is available 24/7, but individuals, our officers and our staff, prefer face-to-face, and though the telephone counselling is there, it hadn't had the take-up that we might have hoped. So we then have increased then the number of counsellors and clinical psychologists that are available.
By how many?
5.
You increased it by 5?
5, yes. And secondly then, we've made available the 24/7 counselling available constantly to officers. And an officer a week, that's on the average, avails of that services. And beyond that, we facilitate officers to attend the police treatment centres, where they get 2 weeks of intensive treatment as well. And so there is a lot that we do around the welfare of our officers. And people, to go back to the phrase you used earlier, people aren't thrown out thrown in a scrap heap. We've invested an awful lot in our officers in terms of training, their expertise and the experience to build up. We want to retain that, and reducing the loss is actually a benefit to the organisation. We do everything to bring people back in terms of recuperative posts, to bring them gently back into the workplace.
No, I do get that. I do get that you do everything to bring them back. But the bigger question is, what do you do with those officers who, through no fault of their own, cannot come back? And by your own admission this morning, what you do is you tell them, you're going to have to go and seek help now outside the police family.
Well, that is what you do.
That's what you've said.
Because a new psychologist and new waiting list
to see a psychologist on the NHS, your officers are then, you know, into a normal system in the NHS. They're no further up than anyone else, and they're having to start a whole process again. How is that fair? Why are you doing it to officers who have risked their lives for this country?
Well, even can I just go back to the relationship with the GP and the National Health Service. Like, this is an ongoing relationship. Anything we do, we also inform the GP about.
No, it's not, Deputy Chief Constable. No, the whole point of the thrust of my question is it's not an ongoing relationship. They are with your clinical expert in your service.
Yes.
And then after you determine they're not coming back, they have to start with a whole new person.
Well, yes.
So it's not ongoing.
But the relationship with their GP is. So we are not their primary health provider. We are their occupational health provider.
It's a bit like the Chief Constable's tweet, isn't it? Move on.
No. We are not saying move on.
Yes, you are.
No, what we're saying is we need to get you back to work.
Yeah, and if you can't come back to work, is your loyalty to those officers?
But our loyalty to those officers is in what we've provided for them to bring them back to work.
Aftercare.
Well,
where's your aftercare loyalty to officers who cannot come back to work?
Well, we have, as I've said, various support mechanisms for retired officers.
Paid for by the force, what are they?
We support various voluntary welfare groups, and we also then, as an organisation, are active in supporting retired officers, and through the benevolent funds, we also support then the work of the police treatment
centre. So your officers have to rely on charities for their aftercare after they're no good to you anymore.
But you see, it's the term "they're no good to us anymore" that I do object to. In effect, people only leave this organisation under a medical retirement when they're unable to perform the full range of duties. When they're able to perform the duties of a constable, and that's through no fault of their own. It may be through illness, or it may have been through stress. But we will have done everything to try and bring them back into the workplace.
I know you will. Well,